fall apart the second I walked in it, or that my dead friends reappeared today, courtesy of my PTSD. I'd been symptom-free since we'd moved. I went to my friends' funerals. I packed up my room. I hung out with my brothers. I did everything I was supposed to do to avoid being Mom's project. And what happened today wasn't remotely worth what telling her would cost. I looked her in the eye. Randomly. She still wasn't buying it. "I'm telling you the truth," I lied. "Can you leave me alone now?" But as soon as I spoke the words, I knew I'd regret them. I was right. We drove the rest of the way home in silence, and the longer we went without speaking, the more obviously she stewed. I tried to ignore her and focus on the route home, since I'd be driving myself to school in a few days thanks to Daniel's long-overdue dentist appointment. It was only mildly comforting that Mr. Perfect had a penchant for cavities. The houses we passed were all low-slung and blocky, with plastic dolphins and hideous Greek-style statues dotting their lawns. It was as if the city council convened and voted to manufacture Miami to be utterly devoid of charm. We passed generic strip mall after generic strip mall, all proclaiming Michaels, Kmart, Home Depot, with their collective might. I couldn't for the life of me fathom why anyone would need more than one set of them within a 50-mile radius. We arrived at our new home after a gut-wrenching hour of traffic, which made my stomach roll with nausea for the second time that day. After pulling all the way into the driveway, my mother exited the car in a huff. I just sat there, motionless. My brothers weren't home yet. My dad definitely wouldn't be home yet. And I didn't want to enter the lion's den alone. I stared at the dashboard, melodramatically, stewing in the juices of my own bitterness, until a knock on the car door made me fly out of my skin. I looked up and out at Daniel. The daylight had dwindled into evening, leaving the sky behind him a deep royal blue. Something inside me flipped. How long had I been sitting there? Daniel peered at me through the open window. "Rough day?" I tried to push my unease aside. "How'd you guess?" Joseph slammed the door of Daniel's Civic, then walked over with a huge smile on his face, his overstuffed backpack hooked between both arms. I got out of the car and clapped my little brother on the shoulder. "How was your first day?" "Awesome! I made the soccer team, and my teacher asked me to try out for the school play next week, and there are some cool girls in my class, but there's also a really weird one who started talking to me, but I was nice to her anyway." I grinned. Of course Joseph would sign up for every extracurricular activity. He was outgoing and talented. Both of my brothers were. I compared the two of them, walking side by side toward the house with their matching gangly strides. Joseph looked more like our mother, and shared her stick-straight hair, unlike me and Daniel. But the two of them inherited her complexion, while I had my father's Whitey McWhiterson skin, and there was no family stamp of similarities in our faces. It made me kind of sad. Daniel opened the door to the house. When we moved here a month ago, I was surprised to discover that I actually liked it. Boxwood topiaries and flowers framed the gleaming front door, and the lot was huge. I remember my father saying that it was almost an acre. But it wasn't home. The three of us entered together, a united front. I could hear my mother stalking in the kitchen, but when she heard us come in, she appeared in the foyer. "Boys," she practically shouted, "how was your day?" She hugged them both pointedly, ignoring me while I hung back. Joseph rehashed every detail with juvenile enthusiasm, and Daniel waited patiently for Mom to lob questions in his direction while he followed them to the kitchen. Seeing an opportunity for escape, I detoured down the long hallway that led to my bedroom, passing three sets of French doors on one side and several family photographs on the other. There were pictures of my brothers and me as infants and toddlers, and a few obligatory, awkward elementary school photos, too. After that, there were pictures of other relatives and my grandparents. Today, one of them caught my eye. An old black-and-white photograph of my grandmother on her wedding day stared back at me from its gilt frame. She was sitting placidly, with her henna hands folded in her lap, her shining jet-black hair parted severely in the middle. The flash in the photo made the bindi sparkle between her perfectly arched eyebrows, and she was swathed in an extravagant fabric, the intricate patterns dancing on the edges of her sari. A strange sensation was there and gone before I could identify it. Then Joseph came running down the hallway 2 inches from knocking me over. "Sorry," he shouted and raced around the corner. I tore my eyes from the picture and escaped into my bedroom, closing the door behind me. I plopped down onto my fluffy white comforter and pushed off my sneakers using my footboard. They fell to the carpet with a dull thud. I stared back at the dark, bare walls of my bedroom. My mother had wanted my room pink, like my old room. Some psychological nonsense about anchoring me in the familiar. So stupid. A paint color wasn't going to bring Rachel back. So I played the pity card and Mom let me choose an emo midnight blue instead. It made the room feel cool, and my white furniture looked sophisticated in it. Small ceramic roses dripped from the arms of the chandelier my mother had installed. But against the dark walls, it didn't overly feminize the room. It worked. And I had my own bathroom for the first time, which was a definite perk. I hadn't hung any sketches or pictures on the walls and didn't plan to. The day before we left Rhode Island, I dismantled the quilt of photos and drawings I'd tacked up, saving a pencil sketch of Rachel's profile for last. I stared at the solitary picture of her then, and marveled at how serious she looked, especially compared to her giddy expression in school. The last I remembered seeing her alive. I didn't see what she looked like at the funeral. It was a closed casket. Chapter 9. Honey, are you sleeping? I startled at the sound of my mother's voice. How much time had passed? I was instantly anxious. A rivulet of sweat rolled down the back of my neck, even though I wasn't hot. I pushed myself up on my bed. No. Her eyes searched my face. Are you hungry? She asked. All traces of her earlier irritation with me were gone. She looked worried now. Again. Dinner's almost ready, she said. Is Dad home? Not yet. He's working on a new case. He probably won't be home for dinner for a while. I'll be in the kitchen in a few. My mother took a tentative step into my room. Was the first day awful? I closed my eyes and sighed. Nothing unexpected, but I'd rather not talk about it. She looked away and I felt guilty. I loved my mother truly. She was devoted. She was nurturing. But in the last year, she'd become painfully present. And in the past month, her hovering was all but unbearable. The day of our move, I spent the 16-hour drive to Florida silent, even though it was for my benefit. I was afraid to fly, and of heights in general. And when we arrived, Daniel told me that after my release, he overheard Mom and Dad arguing about the possibility of hospitalization. Mom was for it, naturally. Someone would be watching me all the time. But I had no desire to study for the SATs in a padded cell. And since the effect of my grand gesture, attending the funerals, had obviously worn off, I needed to keep my crazy in check. It seemed to be working, for now. Mom let the conversation drop and kissed my forehead, before returning to the kitchen. I got out of bed and padded down the hallway in my socks, carefully not to slip on the lacquered wood floor. My brothers had set the table already and my mother was still working on dinner, so I made my way to the family room and sank into the deep leather sofa before turning on the television. The news was on the picture-in-picture view, but I tuned it out as I clicked over the programs in the guide. Mara, turn that up for a second, Mom asked. I complied. Three photographs floated in the corner of the screen. With the help of the Laurelton Police Department's search and rescue unit, the bodies of Rachel Watson and Claire Lowe were recovered this morning, but investigators are having trouble recovering the remains of 17-year-old Jude Lowe due to the wings of the landmark that are still standing, but could collapse at any moment. I squinted at the television. What the? I whispered. Hmm? My mother walked into the family room and took the remote from my hand. When she did, the pictures of my friends vanished. In their place was a photograph of a dark-haired girl smiling happily in the corner of the screen next to the female news anchor. Investigators are pursuing new leads in the case of murdered 10th grader Jordana Palmer, the female anchor trilled. The Metro Dade Police Department is conducting a new search for evidence with a team of canine units in the area bordering the Palmers' property, and Channel 7 has the footage. The image on the screen flashed to a shaky video of a team of police in beige uniforms, accompanied by large German shepherds patrolling a sea of tall grass that stretched behind a row of small new houses. Sources say that the 15-year-old's autopsy reveals disturbing insights into the manner of her death, but officials wouldn't release any details. The leads, like I said, are the result of talking to witnesses that have come forward, and we will be following up on those leads today, said Captain Ron Roseman of the Metro Dade Police Department. Other than that, I can't divulge anything that might compromise our investigation. The anchors then cheerily transitioned to discussing some new literacy initiative in the Broward School District. Mom handed the remote back to me. Can I change it? I asked, careful to keep my voice even. Seeing my dead friends on television had left me shaken, but I couldn't let it show. "Might want to turn it off. Dinner's ready," she said. She looked anxious, more so than usual. I was starting to think she was the one who should be taking medication, and not for the first time. My brothers pulled up to the table, and I pasted on a lopsided grin as I joined them. I tried to laugh at their jokes as we ate, but I couldn't blot out the images of Rachel, Jude, and Claire I'd just seen. No, not seen. Hallucinated. "Something wrong, Mara?" my mother asked, snapping me out of my trance. The expression on my face must have matched my feelings. "No," I said breezily. I stood up, tilting my head forward so that my hair veiled my face. I picked up my plate and made my way to the sink to rinse it off before putting it in the dishwasher. The dish slipped in my soapy hands and broke against the stainless steel. In my peripheral vision, I saw Daniel and my mother's exchange a glance. I was a goldfish without a castle to hide in. "You okay?" Daniel asked me. "Yeah, it just slipped." I picked the shards out of the sink and threw them in the trash before excusing myself to do homework. As I walked back down the hallway to my bedroom, I shot a look at my grandmother's portrait. Her eyes stared back, following me. I was being watched. Everywhere. Chapter 10. That same creeping, watchful feeling escorted me to school the next day. I just couldn't shake it. As Daniel pulled into the school parking lot, he said, "You know, you should think about getting some sun." I shot him a look. "Seriously? I only mention it because you're looking a little peaked." "Duly noted," I said dryly. "We're going to be late if you don't find a spot, you know." Rachmaninoff floated softly from the speakers, doing nothing to settle my jangled mood. Or Daniel's, apparently. "I'm seriously itching to start playing bumper cars here," he said, his jaw clenched. Even though we left early, it still took us 40 minutes to drive to school, and there was already an egregiously long line of luxury cars waiting to pull into the entrance. We watched as two of them vied on opposite ends of the lot for the same space. One of the waiting vehicles, a black Mercedes sedan, squealed its tires as the driver propelled it forward into the spot, cutting off the other car, a blue Focus. The Focus driver pounded one long, sharp note on the horn. "Crazy," Daniel said. I nodded as I watched the driver of the Mercedes exit the car along with another passenger. I recognized the immaculate sheet of blonde hair on the driver even before I saw her face. Anna, naturally. Then I recognized the sour expression of her omnipresent companion, Aiden, as he emerged from the front passenger seat. When we finally found a space, Daniel smiled at me before we parted. "Just text me if you need me, okay? The lunch offer still stands. I'll be fine." The door was still open when I arrived at AP English, but most of the seats were already filled. I sat down at one of the only available desks in the second row and ignored the snickers of a couple students I recognized from Algebra 2. The teacher, Ms. Lieb, was busy writing something on the board. When she finished, she smiled at the class. "Good morning, guys. Who can tell me what this word means?" She pointed to the board where the word hamartia was written. My confidence grew, having already had this lesson. Point one for the Laurelton Public School System. I briefly looked around the class. No one raised a hand. Oh, what the hell. I raised mine. Ah, the new student. I really, really needed that uniform. Miss Lieb's smile was genuine as she leaned against her desk. "Your name?" "Mara Dyer." "Nice to meet you, Mara. Have at it." "Fatal flaw," someone else called out in a British accent. I half turned in my seat and would have recognized the boy from yesterday immediately, even if he hadn't looked as distinctly rumpled as before, with his collar open, his tie knotted loosely around it, and his shirt sleeves rolled up. He was still beautiful, and still smiling. I narrowed my eyes at him. The teacher did the same. "Thank you, Noah, but I called on Mara, and fatal flaw isn't the most precise definition anyway. Care to take a shot at it, Mara?" I did, particularly now that I knew that the British boy was the notorious Noah Shaw. "It means mistake, or error," I said, "sometimes called a tragic flaw." Ms. Lieb gave a congratulatory nod of her head. "Very good. I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume you've read the Three Theban plays at your previous school?" "Yep," I said, fighting self-consciousness. "Then you're ahead of the game. We've just finished Oedipus Rex." Can someone, not Mara, tell me what Oedipus's tragic flaw was? Noah was the only one to raise his hand. Twice in one day, Mr. Shaw. That's out of character. Please demonstrate your dazzling intellect for the class. Noah stared straight at me as he spoke. I was wrong yesterday. His eyes weren't gray. They were blue. His fatal flaw was his lack of self-knowledge. Or his pride, I volleyed back. A debate, Miss Lieb clapped her hands. Love it. I would love it more if the rest of you would look alive, but hey. The teacher turned back to the board and wrote my answer and Noah's answer on the board under hamartia. I think there are arguments to support both claims, that Oedipus's failure to acknowledge who he was, to know himself as it were, caused his downfall, or that his pride, or more correctly, his hubris, led to his tragic fall. And for next Monday, I want a 5-page paper from each of you with your brilliant analysis of the subject. There was a collective groan from the class. Save it. Next week we start anti-heroes. Then she continued on with her lecture, most of which I'd heard before. A bit bored, I took out my thoroughly dog-eared and well-loved copy of Lolita and hid it behind my notebook. The air conditioner in the class must not have been working, and the atmosphere grew increasingly stuffy as the minutes ticked by. When the bell finally rang, I was fiending for some fresh air. I sprung out of my chair, knocking it over. I crouched to lift it and set it right, but my chair was already in someone's hands. Noah's hands. Thanks, I said as our eyes met. He gave me the same familiar, knowing look as yesterday. Slightly ruffled, I broke the stare and gathered my things before hurrying out the classroom. A throng of oncoming students jostled me and my book fell to the ground. A shadow darkened the cover before I could reach for it. You have to be an artist and a madman, a creature of infinite melancholy, in order to discern, at once, the little deadly demon among the wholesome children, he said, his British accent melting around the words, his voice smooth and low. She stands, unrecognized by them, and unconscious herself of her fantastic power. I stood there staring, open-mouthed and speechless. I would have laughed. The whole thing was sort of ridiculous. But the way he said it, the way he was looking at me was shockingly intimate. Like he knew my secrets. Like I had no secrets. But before I could think of a reply, Noah crouched and picked up my book. Lolita, he said, turning my book over in his hands. His eyes wandered over the pink-lipped mouth on the cover, then handed it to me. Our fingers brushed, and a warm current coursed through them. My heart thundered so loud he could probably hear it. So, he said, his eyes meeting mine again, you're a smut hound with daddy issues. The corner of his mouth turned up in a slow, condescending smile. I wanted to smack it off his face. Well, you're quoting it. And incorrectly, by the way. So what does that make you? His half-smile morphed into a whole grin. Oh, I'm definitely a smut hound with daddy issues. Well, I guess you nailed me then. Not yet. Asscrown, I muttered under my breath as I headed to my next class. I wasn't proud of swearing at a complete stranger, no, but he started it. Noah matched my pace. Don't you mean ass clown? He looked amused. No, I said, louder this time. I mean ass crown. The crown on top of the ass hat that covers the asshole of the ass clown. The very zenith in the hierarchy of asses, I said, as though reading from a dictionary of modern profanity. Oh, I guess you nailed me then. Not yet. The words popped into my mind without permission, and I ducked into my algebra classroom and away from him the second I saw the door. I sat in the back, hoping to hide from yesterday's stares and lose myself in the incomprehensibility of the lecture. I cracked Lolita's spine and hid it under my bag. I took out my graph paper, then took out my pencil, then exchanged that pencil for another pencil. Noah was getting under my skin, not healthy. But then Anna primly entered the classroom, accompanied by her not-so-little friend, and cut off my thoughts. The pair walked in like a matched set of evil. She caught me staring, and I quickly looked away, but not without blushing. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched her watching me as she sat in the third row of desks. I was flooded with relief when Jamie slipped into the seat next to me, my only friend at Croydon thus far. "How goes it?" he asked, grinning. I smiled back. No nosebleeds. Yet, Jamie said, and winked. So, who else have you met? Anyone interesting? Besides me, obviously. I lowered my voice and scratched my graph paper. Interesting? No. Asshole-ish? Yes. The dimple in Jamie's cheek deepened. Let me guess. A certain unkempt bastard with a panty-dropping smile? Maybe. Jamie nodded. That blush of yours tells me it is decidedly so. Maybe, I said casually. So, you've met Shaw. What did he say? I wondered why Jamie was so interested. He's an asshole. Yeah, you mentioned that. Now that I think about it, Jamie started, that's what they all say. And yet that boy is drowning in poo. All right, class, take out your problems and pass them to the front, please. Mr. Walsh rose and wrote out an equation on the blackboard. Nice visual, I whispered to Jamie. He winked, just as Anna turned to glare at me. My second day passed in a sea of dreary mundanity. Lectures, homework, bad teacher jokes, homework, in-class assignments, homework. When it ended, Daniel was waiting for me at the campus perimeter, and I was glad to see him. Hey, you, he said. Walk faster so we can have a prayer of getting out of here before the cars clog up the only exit. When I complied, he asked, second day any better than the first? I thought about yesterday. Mildly, I said. But can we not talk about me? How was your day? He shrugged. The usual. People are the same everywhere. Not many stand out. Not many? So some people actually stood out? He rolled his eyes at me. A few. Come on, Daniel. Where's that Croydon enthusiasm? Let's hear it. Daniel dutifully gave me the rundown of his senior class and was in the middle of telling me about a brilliant female violinist in his music study when we arrived back home. The news blared from the living room, but my parents weren't home yet. Must be the little brother. Joseph? Daniel shouted over the din. Daniel? He shouted back. Where's Mom? She went out to get dinner. Dad's coming home early tonight. Did you do your homework? Daniel rifled through the mail on the kitchen table. Did you? Joseph asked without looking up. I'm about to, but nevertheless, I'm not the one engrossed in... What are you watching? CNBC. Daniel paused. Why? They recap on the day's market trends, Joseph replied without missing a beat. Daniel and I exchanged a glance. Then he held up an incredibly thick envelope with no return address. Where did this come from? Dad's new client dropped it off like 2 seconds before you got here. A look passed over Daniel's face. What? I asked him, and then it was gone. Nothing. He made his way to his room, and after a minute, I made my way to mine, leaving Joseph to face the consequences of being caught watching television before doing his homework. He'd charm his way out of them in about 5 seconds. Sometime later, a loud knock startled me from the depths of my Spanish textbook, which I decided was my most hated subject, even worse than math. My dad peeked in through a crack in my door. Mara? Dad, hey! My father walked into my bedroom, obviously tired, but not at all rumpled, despite spending the day in a suit. He sat down on the bed next to me, his silk tie catching the light. So, how's the new school? Why does everyone always ask me about school? I said. There are other things to talk about. He feigned bafflement. Like what? Like the weather or sports. You hate sports. Ah, but I hate school more. Point taken, my dad said, smiling. He then launched into a story about work, and midway through telling me about the lambasting of a clerk for wearing hooker heels by a judge today, my mother called us in for dinner. It was so much easier to laugh with my dad around, and that night I drifted off to sleep easily. But I didn't stay asleep for long. Before. I opened one eye when the pounding on the window grew too loud to ignore. The figure in my window brought his face up to the glass, peering. I knew who it was, and I wasn't surprised to see him. I buried myself under the warm covers, hoping he'd go away. He knocked on it again. No such luck. I'm sleeping, I mumbled under my blanket. He pounded on the glass even louder, and the old window rattled in its wooden frame. He was either going to break it or wake my parents. Both scenarios were undesirable. I inched over to my bedroom window and opened it a crack. I'm not home, I whispered loudly. Very funny. Jude opened the window, shocking me with a jet of cold air. I'm freezing my ass off out here. That problem has a simple solution, I crossed my arms over my tank top. Jude looked confused. His eyes were shaded under the brim of his baseball cap, but it was obvious that he was scanning my nighttime attire. Oh my God, you're not even dressed.
I am dressed. I am dressed for bed. I am dressed for bed because it is 2 in the morning.
He looked at me, his eyes wide and mocking.
You forgot?
Yeah, I lied, leaning out the window slightly and checked the driveway. Are they waiting in the car? Jude shook his head. They're at the asylum already. It's just us. Come on.
Chapter 11. I woke in the middle of the night with a scream in my throat and an anchor on my chest, soaking in sweat and terror. I remembered. The flood of recognition was almost painful. Jude at my window, there to pick me up and bring me to awaiting Rachel and Claire. That was how I got there that night. The memory wasn't frightening, but the fact that it existed almost was. Or maybe not frightening, maybe thrilling. I knew with everything in me that my sleeping mind hadn't invented it, that the memory was real. I probed the edges of my consciousness for something more, but there was nothing, no hint of why we'd gone. My veins were flooded with adrenaline, and I could not fall back asleep. The dream, the memory, kept replaying itself on a loop, disturbing me more than it should have. Why now, all of a sudden? What could I do about it? What should I do about it? I needed to remember the night I lost Rachel, for her sake, for mine. Even though my mother wouldn't agree, my mind was protecting itself from the trauma, she'd say. Trying to force it was unhealthy. After the second night of the same dream, the same terror, I silently began to agree with her. I was a basket case in school that day, and the day after that. The Miami breeze blew hot, but I felt the frigid December air of New England on my arms instead. I saw Jude at my window when I closed my eyes. I thought of Rachel and Claire waiting for me, at the asylum. The asylum. But with everything on my plate at Croydon, I needed, more than anything, to relax. And so it was that I focused on little details that Friday morning. The swirling column of gnats that I almost choked on when exiting Daniel's car in the parking lot. The air swollen with humidity. Anything to avoid thinking about the new dream, memory, whatever, that had become a part of my nightly repertoire. I was glad Daniel had a dentist appointment this morning. I did not want to talk. When I arrived at school, the parking lot was still empty. I'd overestimated the amount of time it would take to get there in traffic. Lightning flashed in distant purple clouds that spread over the sky like a dark quilt. It was going to rain, but I couldn't sit still. I had to do something, to move, to shake off the memory that gnawed at my mind. I threw open the car door and walked, passing more than a few empty scraggly lots and some rundown houses. I don't know how far I'd gone before I heard the whimper. I stopped and listened for the sound again. A chain-link fence stood in front of me, punctuated by barbed wire. There was no grass, only light brown, tightly packed dirt and mud in places where the ground was wet with last night's rain. Junk littered the space, machinery parts, pieces of cardboard, and some garbage, and a very large pile of lumber. Nails were scattered across the dirt. I crept up to the barbed wire and tried to stand on my toes to see the entire expanse of the space. Nothing. I crouched, hoping to gain a different vantage point. My eyes panned over a cluster of car parts and moved across the scattered garbage to the lumber pile. The dog's short, fawn-colored fur almost blended into the dust under the precariously stacked wood. She was emaciated. Every bone in her spine protruded from her patchy coat. Curled up into a tiny ball, the dog trembled despite the oppressive heat. Her black muzzle had numerous scars, and her ears were torn and almost invisible behind her head. She was in really, really bad shape. I looked for a way inside the yard, but saw none. I crouched and called her to me in the kindest, highest voice I could muster. She crawled out of the pile and walked to the fence with halting, tentative steps, looking through the metal with liquid brown eyes. I had never seen anything so pathetic in my life. I couldn't leave her there, not like that. I would have to skip school and get her out. That's when I noticed the collar. The leather collar was secured with a padlock, attached to a chain so heavy it was incredible the dog could even stand. It didn't even need to be staked into the ground. She was going nowhere. I petted her muzzle through the fence and tried to assess whether I could slip the collar over her large, bony head. I cooed to her, getting her to come closer so I could feel how tight it was, but just as I gained purchase under it, a nasal drawl interrupted the silence from just a few feet away. "What the hell do you think you're doing with my dog?" I looked up. The man stood on my side of the fence and he was close, too close. It was not good that I didn't hear him approach. He wore a stained wife beater and torn jeans, and his long, greasy hair receded into a skullet. "What do you say to someone whose dog you plan to steal?"
"Hi."
"I asked what you're doing with my dog." He squinted at me with bloodshot, watery blue eyes. I tried to swallow my desire to bludgeon him to death with a tree limb and stalled, leaving his question hanging in the air. My options, being a teenage girl and not knowing whether this asshole had a knife or gun in his pocket, were limited. I used my best innocent dumb girl voice. "Well, I was just on my way to school and saw your dog. She's so sweet. What kind is she?" I hoped this would be enough to deter him from pillaging me for breakfast. I held my breath.
"She's a pit bull. Ain't you never seen one before?"
He ejected a wad of some foul substance from his mouth onto the dirt. "Not one that skinny. I'd never seen any dog or any animal that thin."
"Nope. What a great dog. Does she eat much?"
An obscenely stupid question. My lack of filter was going to get me killed one of these days. Maybe today.
"What do you care?"
"Oh, well, go big or go home." "She's starving, and that chain around her neck is too heavy. She has bites on her ears and scars on her face. Is this really the best you can do for her?" I said, my voice growing shrill. "She doesn't deserve this." I was losing it. His jaw clenched along the muscles in his body. He walked right up to my face. I held my breath but didn't move.
"Who the hell do you think you are?" he said,
his voice a raspy hiss.
"Get out of here, and if I see you around here again, I ain't gonna be this nice next time we meet."
I inhaled without meaning to, and a noxious odor wafted in my direction. I looked down at the dog, cringing away from her owner. I didn't want to leave her, but I couldn't see how to get around the obstacles. The barbed wire, the padlock collar, and heavy chain. Her owner. So I tore my eyes away and began to leave. Then I heard a scream. When I whipped around, the dog cowered so low she hugged to the ground. Her owner held the heavy chain. He must have jerked it. The sick bastard smiled at me. I swelled with loathing, brimmed with it. I'd never hated anyone as much as I hated him in that moment. My fingers itched with the violence they wanted to do but couldn't, so I turned and ran. To give my trembling limbs some relief from the fury that boiled up from the dark place I didn't know existed. My feet pounded the pavement, wishing they could trample the smile on that piece of filth's face. And as the thought spiked through my brain, I saw it. The redneck skull caved in, leaving a gaping, pulpy hole in the side of his head. A thick cloud of flies clogging his mouth. Blood staining the sandy dirt by the lumber pile in a wide, darkening pool around his body. He deserved to die. Chapter 12. Sweaty and breathless, I rounded the parking lot by the school entrance and checked my watch. 7 minutes to spare before English. I grabbed my bag from the car, sprinted to class, and made it a minute before the bell rang. Slick. Miss Leib closed the door behind me and I settled into the nearest available desk. Noah was there, looking as bored and careless and disheveled as ever. He sat at his desk without his book or notes, but that didn't stop him from answering each of Miss Leib's questions correctly when she called on him. Show off. My mind wandered against the backdrop of the lecture. I had to do something about the dog. Help her, somehow. I'd just started to envision a dubious plan involving wire cutters, a ski mask, and mace when the bell rang. I made my way toward the door, anxious to get to my next class, but a throbbing mass of students had already assembled in front of it, crowding the exit. When I finally escaped the confines of the classroom, I found myself staring directly into Anna's face, her nose wrinkled in disgust.
"Don't you shower?"
I probably did smell ripe after this morning's sprint, but I was in no mood for her garbage. Not today. I opened my mouth, ready to let the abuse fly.
I vastly prefer the unshowered to the over-perfumed, don't you, Anna?
That voice could only be Noah's. I turned around. He stood behind me wearing an almost imperceptible smile. Anna's blue eyes went wide. Her face transformed from evil to innocent, like magic, only more nefarious.
I guess if those are your only two choices, Noah, then yes. But I'm partial to neither.
Could have fooled me, Noah said. That did not seem to be the response she'd been expecting from him.
Whatever,
she stammered, refocusing her gaze in my direction and staring daggers before she walked away.
Fabulous.
Now she and I were definitely going to have a thing. I turned to face Noah. He shot an insolent smile at me, and I bristled.
You didn't have to do that, I said. I was handling it.
A simple thank you would suffice. Rain began to spatter the roof of the walkway. I really need to get to class, I said, and picked up my pace. Noah matched it.
What do you have next?
He asked lightly.
Algebra 2? Go away. I'm smelly and you bother me enormously.
I'll walk with you.
Fail.
I shifted my bag to my other shoulder, bracing myself for an uncomfortably silent walk. Out of nowhere, Noah tugged on my messenger bag, jerking me to a halt.
Did you draw that?
He asked, indicating the graffiti on my messenger bag.
Yep. You're talented, he said.
I looked at his face. No sarcasm, no amusement.
Was it possible?
Thanks, I said, disarmed. Now it's your turn.
For what?
To compliment me.
I ignored him.
We can continue to walk in silence, Mara, or you can ask me a bit about myself until we reach the classroom.
He was infuriating.
What makes you think I'm at all curious about you?
I asked.
Nothing, he replied. In fact, I'm quite sure you're not at all curious. It's intriguing.
Why's that? My classroom was at the end of the hall, not much longer now.
Because most girls I meet here ask where I'm from when they hear my accent, and they're usually thrilled to have the pleasure of my conversation.
Oh, the arrogance.
It's English, by the way.
Yeah, I caught that.
Only 10 feet left. I was born in London.
7 feet left, not going to respond.
My parents moved here from England 2 years ago.
4 feet.
I don't have a favorite color, though I strongly dislike yellow. Horrid color.
2 feet.
I play the guitar, love dogs, and hate Florida.
Noah Shaw played dirty. I smiled despite myself, and then we reached the classroom. I darted to the back of the room and planted myself at a desk in the corner. Noah followed me in. He wasn't even in this class. Noah took the seat next to me, and I pointedly ignored the fit of his clothes on his narrow frame as he slid by. Jamie walked in and sat on my other side, giving me a long look before shaking his head. I took up my graph paper and prepared to calculate, which meant that I doodled until Mr. Walsh came around to collect last night's homework. He stopped at the desk Noah was now occupying.
"Can I help you, Mr. Shaw?"
"I'm auditing your class today, Mr. Walsh. I'm in desperate need of an algebraic brush-up."
"Uh-huh," Mr. Walsh said dryly. "Do you have a note?"
Noah stood and left the room. He returned as Mr. Walsh reviewed last night's homework and, sure enough, handed the teacher a piece of paper. The teacher said nothing, and Noah sat back down next to me.
What kind of school was this?
When Mr. Walsh began to speak again, I doodled furiously in my notebook again and ignored Mr. Walsh. The dog. Noah had distracted me, and I needed to figure out how to save her. Thoughts of the dog consumed my morning. I didn't think about Noah, even though he stared at me in algebra with the single-minded focus of a kitten playing with a ball of yarn. I didn't look at him once as I took notes, and didn't notice his permanently amused expression while I fidgeted in my seat. Or the way he ran his long fingers through his hair every 5 seconds. Or how he rubbed his eyebrow whenever Mr. Walsh asked me a question. Or the way he leaned his coarse cheek into his hand and just stared at me. When class finally ended, Anna looked primed for murder. Jamie booked it before I could say a word, and Noah waited as I gathered my things. He had no things. No notebooks. No books. No bag. It was bizarre. My confusion must have shown on my face because that delinquent grin was back. I resolved to wear something yellow the next time I saw him. Yellow from head to toe, if I could manage it. We walked in silence until a swinging door ahead caught my eye. The bathroom, an ingenious idea. When we reached it, I turned to Noah.
I'm going to be here for a while. You probably don't want to wait.
I only briefly caught the horrified expression on his face before I pushed open the door with overwhelming force. Win. There were a few girls in the bathroom of indeterminate age, but they paid no attention to me as they left. I was glad to get away from Noah, so I stifled the part of me that wanted to know his favorite song to play on guitar. Jamie had warned me about this nonsense. Noah was toying with me, and I'd be foolish to forget it. And none of this was important. The dog was important. During algebra, while ignoring Noah, I decided to call animal control and file a complaint against abuser douche. I took out my cell phone. Surely someone would be sent to follow up on my complaint and see that the dog was on the brink of death. Then they'd get her out of there. I dialed information, asking for the number of the city's animal control office, and scribbled it down on my hand. The phone rang 3 times before a female voice answered.
This is Animal Control, Officer Diaz. Can I help you?
Yes, I am calling to complain about a neglected dog. It was impossible to sit still during the rest of the day, knowing that after school I had to check on the dog to make sure she was safe. I fidgeted in my chair, in every class, earning me extra homework in Spanish. When school ended, I flew down the slick stairs and almost broke my neck. The rain had stopped, for now, but it had infiltrated the covered walkways, making my progress treacherous. I was halfway to the parking lot when my cell phone rang. It wasn't a number I recognized, and I needed to concentrate on my footing anyway. I ignored it and jogged in the direction of the dog's house, but lights flashed ahead as I rounded the corner. My stomach flip-flopped. It could be a good sign. Maybe they arrested the guy. Still, I slowed to a walk as I approached, my fingers trailing the crumbling wall on the opposite side of the chain-link fence. I listened to the voices and the tinny sound of the police radio in front of me. As I neared the house, I saw a cruiser with the lights on and an unmarked car. And an ambulance. The hair stood up on the back of my neck. When I reached the yard, the front door of the house was open. People stood next to the cars by the quiet ambulance. My eyes scanned the property, looking for the dog. But as they reached the lumber pile, my blood froze. You couldn't see his mouth at all, with the teeming mass of flies bubbling over it, and the side of the pulpy mess that had been the man's scalp. The ground under his caved-in head was completely black, and the stain blossomed red at the edges of his dingy wife-beater. The dog's owner was dead. Exactly as I imagined it. Chapter 13. The trees, sidewalk, and the flashing lights spun around me as I felt it. The first unmistakable snarl in the delicate fabric of my sanity. I laughed. I was that crazy. Then I threw up. Large hands grabbed my shoulders. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a woman in a suit and a man in a dark uniform approach, but they were out of focus. Whose hands were on me?
Great, just great. Get her out of here, Gadsden.
The female voice said. She sounded so far away.
Shut it, Foley. You could have set up a perimeter just as easily, said the man's voice from behind me.
He spun me around as I wiped my mouth. He was also in a suit.
What's your name?
He asked with authority.
Mamara,
I stammered. I could barely hear myself.
Can you bring the EMTs over here? He shouted. She might be in shock.
I snapped to attention. No paramedics. No hospitals.
I'm fine, I said, and willed the trees to stop dancing.
I took a few deep breaths to steady myself.
Was this even happening?
I've just never seen a dead body before. I said it before I even realized it was true. I hadn't seen Rachel, Claire, and Jude at their funerals. There wasn't enough of them left to see.
Just to take a look, the man said. Well, I ask you some questions, if that's all right.
He signaled to the EMT.
I knew it wasn't a fight I could win.
Okay, I said. I closed my eyes but still saw the blood and the flies. But where's the dog? I opened my eyes and looked for her, but didn't see her anywhere. The EMT approached me, and I tried to focus on not appearing insane. I breathed slowly and evenly as he flashed his penlight in both of my eyes. He looked me over, but just as he seemed to be wrapping it up, I overheard the female detective speak.
Where the hell is Diaz?
She said she'll be here soon. The voice belonged to the man who had been talking to me a minute ago.
You want to go and tie up that dog better?
No. I didn't want to touch it. I could see fleas crawling in its fur.
Ladies and gentlemen, Miami's finest. Go to hell, Gadsden. Calm down. The dog's not going anywhere. It can barely walk, let alone run away. Not that it matters. It's a pit bull. They're just going to euthanize it.
What? There's no way the dog did it. The guy tripped and cracked his skull open on the stake by the lumber pile. See? Don't even need to wait for the text to tell us that.
I didn't say the dog did it. I just said they're going to euthanize it anyway.
Shame. At least it'll be put out of its misery.
After everything she'd been through, the dog was going to be put to sleep. Killed. Because of me.
I felt sick again. My hand trembled as the EMT took my pulse.
How are you feeling now? He asked in a quiet voice. His eyes were kind.
Fine, I lied. Really, I'm all right now. I hoped that saying it would be enough to convince him that it was actually true.
Then we're all done, Detective Gadsden.
The male detective and the suited woman made their way over to us, and the man, Detective Gadsden, thanked the EMT as he headed back to the ambulance. Other people milled about around it, some in uniform and some not, and a truck had pulled up, with the words Medical Examiner stenciled on the back. A slimy fear coated my tongue.
Mara, is it?
Detective Gadsden asked me as his partner took out her notepad. I nodded.
What's your last name?
Dyer, I answered. His partner wrote it down. The armpits of her tan suit were darkened with sweat. So were his. But for the first time in Miami, I wasn't hot. I shivered.
What brought you here this afternoon, Mara? He asked.
I swallowed. I was the one who called in the complaint about the dog.
No point lying about that. I left my name and phone number with the animal control office.
His eyes didn't waver from my face, but I noticed a change in his expression. He waited for me to continue. I cleared my throat. I just wanted to stop by after school and see if animal control had picked her up. At that, he nodded.
Did you see anyone else when you were here this morning?
I shook my head. Where do you go to school? He asked.
Croydon.
The female detective wrote that down, too. I hated when she did that. He asked me a few more questions, but I couldn't keep my eyes from searching for the dog. The body must have been moved while I was being examined because it was now gone. A metallic door slammed shut, and I jumped. I hadn't noticed that Detective Gadsden had stopped speaking. He was waiting for me to say something.
Sorry, I said, as a few fat raindrops pelted the metal and tin scraps like bullets. It was going to pour again, and soon.
I didn't hear you.
Detective Gadsden studied my face. I said my partner will walk you back to campus. The female detective looked like she wanted to go back inside the house.
I'm really fine, I smiled, demonstrating just how fine I was.
It's not far at all, but thank you anyway, I said.
I'd be much more comfortable if she said she's fine, Vince. Come and take a look at this, will you?
Detective Gadsden eyed me carefully. Thanks for calling it in.
I shrugged. I had to do something.
Of course. If you remember anything else, the detective said, handing me his business card, call me anytime.
I will, thank you. I walked away, but when I turned the corner, I leaned against the cool stucco wall and listened.
One pair of footsteps crunched on gravel, soon accompanied by a second. The detectives talked to each other, and a third voice joined them, one I didn't remember hearing. Someone must have been in the house before I got there.
Best guess, he died about 7 hours ago.
So around 9 a.m. then?
9, just a few minutes after I'd left him. I couldn't swallow. My throat was so dry.
That's my guesstimate. The heat and the rain don't help. You know how it is.
I know how it is.
I heard something then about temp and lividity and tripping and trajectories over the loud rush of blood pounding in my ears. When the footsteps and voices faded away, I chanced a peek around the wall. They were gone. Inside the house, possibly? And from this angle, I could see the dog. She was tied loosely to a tire at the end of the yard, her fur blending in with the dirt. The rain now fell steadily, but she didn't even flinch. I ran to her without thinking. My cotton t-shirt was quickly soaked, though. I dodged garbage and car parts, stepping as gingerly as I could, grateful for the rain that masked the sound of my steps. But if anyone in the house was paying attention, I'd probably be heard, and I'd definitely be seen. When I reached the dog, the sky opened vengefully as I knelt and untied her lead from the tire. I tugged on it lightly.
Come,
I whispered by her ear. The dog didn't move. Maybe she couldn't. Her neck was raw and seeping where they cut away the heavy collar, and I didn't want to pull on it. But then the voices grew louder as they approached us. We had no time. I snaked one arm around the dog's ribs and lifted her into a standing position. She was weak, but stayed up. I whispered to her again and pushed gently on her rump to urge her forward. She took a step, but went no farther. My cells buzzed with panic. So I lifted her into my arms. She wasn't as heavy as she should have been, but she was still heavy. I lurched forward, taking huge strides until we were out of the yard. Sweat and rain slicked my hair to my forehead and my neck. I was panting by the time we rounded the block. My knees shook as I set her down. I wasn't sure I could carry her all the way back to Daniel's car. And what would I do then? I hadn't thought that far ahead, but now the enormity of the situation I'd stepped in hit me. The dog needed a vet. I had no money. My parents weren't animal people. I'd stolen something from a crime scene. A crime scene! An image of the bright watermelon insides of the man's skull spilling over into the dirt appeared again in my mind. He was definitely dead. Only hours after I wished it. Exactly the way I wished it. A coincidence? Had to be. Had to be. The dog whined, snapping me back to reality. I reached down to pet her and took a tentative step forward, careful not to let the leash rub against her neck. It looked so painful. I urged her forward and reached into my pocket for my cell phone. I had one new voice message, from my mother, at her new office. I couldn't call her back yet. I needed to get the dog to an animal hospital. I'd call 411 to find a vet close by. Then I'd figure out how to break the news to my parents that, surprise, we have a dog. They had to take pity on their screwed-up daughter and her pathetic companion. I was not above milking my tragedy for a higher purpose. The rain stopped again as suddenly as it had started, leaving only a fine mist in its wake. And as we turned the corner before the parking lot, I noticed a particular lope of a particular boy as he headed in my direction. He raked those fingers through his rain-drenched hair and fiddled with something in his shirt pocket. I tried to duck behind the nearest parked car to avoid him, but the dog barked at that exact second, busted. "Mara," he said as he approached us. He inclined his head, and the shadow of a smile made his eyes crinkle at the corners. "Noah," I replied in the flattest voice I could muster. I kept walking. "You going to introduce me to your friend?" His clear gaze settled on the dog. His jaw tightened as he took in the details. Her knobby spine, her patchy fur, her scars. And for a second, he looked coldly, quietly furious. But then it was replaced by a careful blankness. I tried to appear casual, like I always went on my afternoon constitutional in the rain, accompanied by an emaciated animal. "I'm otherwise occupied, Noah. Nothing to see here. Where are you going?" There was an edge to his voice that I didn't like. "My God, you're like the plague!" A masterfully crafted, powerfully understated, an epic parable of timeless moral resonance. Why, thank you. That's one of the nicest things anyone's ever said to me, he said. "The disease, Noah, not the book. I'm ignoring that qualification. Can you ignore it while getting out of my way? I have to find a vet." I lowered my eyes to the dog. She was staring at Noah and weakly wagged her tail as he leaned down to pet her. For the dog I found. My heart pounded as my tongue formed my lie. Noah raised an eyebrow at me, then checked his watch. "It's your lucky day. I know a vet 6 minutes from here." I hesitated. "Really? How random." "Really. Come along. I'll drive you." I debated the situation. The dog needed help, and badly. And she'd get looked at much, much sooner if Noah drove. With my sense of direction, I could end up driving aimlessly around South Miami until 4 in the morning. I would go with Noah. "Thanks," I said and nodded at him. He smiled, and the three of us walked over to his car, a Prius. He opened the back door, took the leash from my hands, and despite the dog's patchy coat and the fact that she was infested with fleas, scooped her up and placed her on the upholstery. If she peed all over his car, I would die. I had to warn him. "Noah," I said, "I just found her 2 minutes ago. She's a stray, and I don't know anything about her or if she's housebroken or anything, and I don't want her to ruin..." Noah placed his forefinger above my upper lip and his thumb below my bottom lip and applied the slightest pressure, cutting me off. I felt lightheaded, and my eyelids might have fluttered close. So embarrassing. I wanted to kill myself a little. "Shut up," he said quietly. "It doesn't matter. Let's just get her checked out, all right?" I nodded feebly, my pulse galloping in my veins. Noah walked over to the passenger side and opened the car door for me. I climbed in.
Chapter 14. I settled into the seat, acutely aware of my proximity to him. Noah fumbled in his pocket and pulled out a pack of cigarettes, then a lighter. I spoke before I could help myself.
You smoke?
He flashed a small, mischievous smile at me.
Would you like one? He asked.
Whenever he arched his eyebrows like that, his forehead creased in the most appealing way. There was something wrong with me, absolutely. I chalked it up to my deteriorating sanity and avoided his eyes. No, I would not like one. Cigarettes are disgusting. Noah placed the pack back in the top pocket of his shirt.
I don't have to smoke if it bothers you, he said, but the way he said it set me on edge.
It doesn't bother me, I said. If you don't mind looking 40 years old at 20, smelling like an ashtray and getting lung cancer, why should I? The words tumbled out of my mouth. So obnoxious, but I couldn't help it. Noah brought out the worst in me. Feeling a tad guilty, I snuck a glance at him to see if he was annoyed. Of course not. He just looked amused. I find it hilarious that whenever I light up, Americans look at me like I'm going to urinate on their children. And thanks for your concern, but I've never been ill a day in my life.
How nice for you.
It is nice, yes. Now, do you mind if I drive this starving dog in the back of my car to the veterinarian? And the guilt was gone. A rush of heat spread from my cheeks to my collarbone. I'm sorry. Is driving and talking too complicated? No problem. I'll shut up. Noah opened his mouth as if to speak, then closed it again and shook his head. He pulled out of the parking lot and we sat in an awkward silence for 9 minutes, thanks to a train. When we reached the vet's office, Noah left the car and started walking to the passenger side. I flung my door open just in case he had a mind to open it. His coltish gait didn't change. Instead, he opened the back door and reached for the dog. The upholstery was mercifully free of canine bodily fluids as he lifted the dog out, but instead of placing her on the ground, Noah carried her all the way to the door of the building. She nuzzled into his chest. Traitor. As we neared the door, he asked me what her name was. I shrugged. I have no idea. I told you, I found her 10 minutes ago.
Yes, Noah said, cocking his head to one side.
You did tell me that, but they're gonna need a name to register her under.
Well, pick one then. I shifted my weight from foot to foot, growing nervous. I didn't have a clue how I was going to pay for the vet visit, or what I would say once we went inside.
Hmm, Noah murmured. He looked at the dog with a serious expression. What's your name? I threw my head back in exasperation. I just wanted to get this over with. Noah ignored me, taking his sweet time. After an eternity, he smiled.
Mabel. Your name is Mabel, he told the dog.
She didn't even look up at him. She was still curled up comfortably in his arms.
Can we go in now? I asked.
You're a piece of work, he declared. Now be a gentleman and open the door for me. My hands are full.
I complied, sulking the whole time. When we walked in, the receptionist's eyes widened as she took in the dog's appearance. She rushed off to get the vet, and my mind raced, trying to think of what I could possibly say to finagle treatment for the dog without having to pay for it. A cheerful voice from the other side of the large waiting area startled me from my scheming.
Noah! A petite woman emerged from one of the examining rooms. Her face was pleasant, alight with surprise.
What are you doing here?
She asked, beaming at him as he bent over and kissed both her cheeks. Curious.
Hello, Mum, Noah said. This is Mabel.
He nodded down at the dog tucked into his arms. My schoolmate Mara found him near campus. It took a conscious exertion of will to nod my head. Noah's smile suggested that he noticed my bewilderment and enjoyed it. I'm going to take her in the back to weigh her. She motioned to the veterinary assistant, who gently extracted the dog from Noah's arms. Then it was just me and Noah in the waiting area. Alone.
So, I started, you didn't think to mention that your mother was a vet?
You never asked, he said. He was right, of course, but still. When his mother came back into the room, she outlined the various treatments she was going to administer, which included keeping the dog over the weekend for observation. I silently thanked the heavens. That would buy me some time to figure out what I was going to do with her. After she finished ticking off a list of Mabel's ailments, Noah's mother looked at me expectantly.
Guess I couldn't delay the payment discussion any further.
Dr. Shaw?
I hated the sound of my voice.
I'm sorry, I don't have any money with me, but if the receptionist can give me an estimate, I can get to